Chazor Shir Perek Zayin Mishnah Ches until Perek Tes Mishnah Tes. The last two Mishnahs of Perek Zayin discuss certain blemishes on a man or woman who, if their husband or wife wants them to get divorced because of those blemishes, they are forced to do so. Firstly, Rav Meir holds that if you get engaged to a woman and then you find out that she has a blemish, then the kiddushin, the engagement, is retroactively invalid. Because it was a mekach to'us, meaning it was she tricked you into getting engaged to her because you didn't know about that, and you would not have got engaged to her had you known. And therefore it's invalid unless the father of the woman can prove that it developed after the kiddushin actually happened. And the Chachom said, if it's a revealed blemish, meaning that everyone knows about it, or there's a bathhouse in that city that everyone goes to, and therefore he would know about the blemishes on her, therefore it was obviously not a mekach to'us, and therefore the kiddushin would be valid. However, everyone agrees that if you've already married her, and then you find she has a blemish, then the kiddushin would be valid, unless proven otherwise. We then discussed the man's blemishes, and we said that ordinarily he would not be forced to divorce her, unless he has a very bad stench and he smells, then he would be. But according to Moshim Ben Gamliel, if it's a big blemish, for example, he's broken his leg or something, then even he would be forced to divorce his wife. Rav Meir held that even if she says when she gets married that she doesn't mind the blemish, and she's getting married to him even despite his blemish, if she then, once she marries him, decides that, oh, she can't bear it, she's allowed to get divorced. But according to the Chachomim, if she made that condition when she got married, she can't. And then lastly, we brought a story that someone who had a bad stench died. And then his brother had to yibum on the woman, and he also had a bad stench, and the Chacham said that she can say, I could bear your brother, but I can't bear you, and therefore you need to do chalitza and not yibum. Perches discussed all the man's rights to his wife's property, and we brought four different categories of property which fell to his wife or his arusa, the person who he was engaged to, and whether if she sells it, it's valid or not. Number one was if she got it before she was engaged, then even once she's engaged, she's allowed to sell it. If she acquired it once she was already engaged, then it was machlokes. Beis Shammai said she can sell it, Beis Hillel said she couldn't. However, even Beis Hillel held that if she did sell it, it would be valid. If she acquired it once she was already married, then everyone agrees she's also to sell it. And if she does go ahead and sell it, then it would be invalid. And lastly, if she got it before she got married and then she got married, can she sell it? No, she can't. But if she did sell it, then it would be valid. But Rabbi Shimon hold that if she does go and sell it, then it would be invalid, unless the husband didn't know that she had that property in the first place, only then would it be valid. We then brought in the concept of keren and peiros. Keren means that it's property which belongs to her, and it produces peiros, and we know that the husband can benefit from those peiros. Whereas if that property itself is considered peiros, then you have to sell that for a keren, something, for example, for land, and that land would become a keren, and then produce peiros, and then the husband can benefit from those peiros. Since the rule is, the husband can only benefit from his wife's peiros, and not the actual keren. And we had a machlekes about whether produce which is still attached to the ground when it falls to the woman, is that considered peiros or keren? According to Meir, it's considered keren, since it had already grown. In order for something to be considered peiros, it had to have grown in her property when she owned it. Since it had grown before she owned it, it's considered keren. However, according to the Chachamim, it's considered peiros, since at the end of the day, it did grow from her land, and her land is considered the keren, and the produce is considered the peiros already, and therefore you would not need to sell it for land. According to the Chachamim, you can even eat those peiros already. Rabbi Shimon argued on one point, and he held that if they get divorced, then produce which is still connected to the ground is considered like the ground, and therefore belongs to her, whereas the Chachamim held that even though it's attached to the ground, since it grew while the husband had rights to the peiros, they would still belong to him when they get divorced. If she brought into the marriage old servants or olive trees or grapevines, all these things don't produce very much when they're old, and therefore, according to Tanakama, he's allowed to buy land with them if he wants to, but according to Moshim Megamliel and Rabbi Yehuda in other cases, they held that he's not allowed to sell them if she doesn't want to, because they represent the pride of her father's house, the fact that they've had these servants, etc., for so long, and therefore he would not be able to sell it. The Mishnah then said, if he invested in her field and spent lots of money on improving it, and then he got divorced from her, he's not compensated unless he didn't take anything. Only if he didn't take anything, then he can take the money which he spent. But if he ate any amount of the peiros which he spent money on, then that's already considered like he's received his peiros and he would not receive compensation. The Mishnah then discussed a Shomeres Yovam. A Shomeres Yovam is someone whose husband has died and she's waiting for the Yibam for the Yovam to do Yibam on her. And whereas someone who's engaged cannot necessarily sell it lechatchila, since she's definitely about to get married to that man, a Shomeres Yovam might do chalitza, and therefore she's allowed to sell it, even lechatchila, she's allowed to sell that property. What happens if she dies? Then we had a difference between two types of property. Nichsei Tzoin Barzel, which includes the Ksuba, and Nichsei Maloi. Nichsei Tzoin Barzel is something which has the fixed value, and when she brings it in or out of the marriage, she will get the value. Not the actual thing, she'll get the value when she gets divorced. And that is considered the husband's. Whereas Nichsei Maloig, she gets the actual property when she gets divorced, and that's considered hers. So according to Reish Shammai, you split it all between the Yovam and her inheritors, which could be her father or her father's inheritors. According to Reish Hillel, the Nichsei Tzoin Barzel and Ksuba go to the Yovam because the Yovam is taking over of the husband, and the Tzoin Barzel property belonged to the husband, whereas the Nichsei Maloig would go to her inheritors since the Nichsei Maloig fundamentally belonged to her. What happens if he actually did yim with her? She didn't die, rather the Yovam did yim with her. So here the Chachomim agree with Rabbi Meir that produce which is attached to the ground is considered keren and belongs to her, and therefore you need to buy land with it, and then the husband can only benefit from the payers of the land you buy with it. But Rabbi Meir and the Chachomim argued on metaltelin objects, things which are considered payers. So Rabbi Meir held that the husband can benefit from them straight away. The Yovam in this case can benefit from them straight away, whereas the Chachom held that it's first come, first serve, meaning the Yovam can take it unless the woman had already taken them while her husband was still alive. If she did, then it would belong to her. If not, then it would belong to the Yovam. Then we said a halacha about Yibam, that Yibam is considered the same as marriage, except for one thing, that the Ksuba, the Yovam does not need to pay for the Ksuba, rather it comes from the husband's money, the inheritance, that money. And then we said that all the inheritance of the which the Yovam inherits from the dead husband, he's not allowed to sell it because it's all an achrayis nechosim for the kesubah that he needs to pay to her, which, as we said, comes from the inheritance. The beginning of Perek Tes discussed if the man wants to relinquish his rights over his wife's property, usually he has rights to use to have the payros of her property. If he says, I don't want it, so if he says, I just don't want your property, then actually he's allowed to benefit from the payros still, because he didn't specify the payros, he said the property. And anyway, he doesn't have right to the property, he only has right over the payros, and if he didn't mention the payros, then he's still allowed to benefit from them. If he did specify the payros, only then would he be also with the payros, but according to Rabbi Yehuda, even then he would be allowed to have the payros' payros, meaning he could take the payros, sell them for land, and then have the payros of that land, and that would not be considered the payros, and therefore she's still not allowed to sell the property. Meaning as long as he has a right over some sort of payros, even if it's the payros' payros, she's not allowed to sell the field. But either way, according to both of these opinions, and in both cases, he would still inherit her because his statement that he's cancelling his rights only applies during the wife's lifetime. But if he specifies specifically that it should last even after his husband has died, then according to the Tanakhama it would be also, but according to Moshim Megamliel, in that case the whole Tanai would fall apart. The whole condition would fall apart and it doesn't work because he is masne al masha kosuv ba-Torah. He's making a condition going against the Torah because the Torah says that a husband will inherit his wife. He's now saying, oh, I'm not going to inherit you, and he can't do that and therefore it will be invalid. Then the mission discussed the fact that usually we have a rule that metaltalin objects are not part of the achrayis nechosim on her ksuba. It's only considered proper land which can have an achrayis nechosim on the ksuba. However, we had a machlokes if the metaltalin had not yet been inherited by the inheritors. For example, the husband had lent money to someone else and he comes back to repay it. So since the inheritors have not yet acquired it, so we had a machlokes to be tarifin held, that you give it, the wife can now collect her ksuba even from the metaltalin. And the same one would apply for a baal choyv, someone who is owed money by the husband, he could also take that. But a contrary Akiva, he said, Ein merachem adin. We don't have mercy on the woman just because she's in a more disadvantaged position, and therefore we give it to the inheritors. Why? Because the woman would have to make a shavua if she wants to receive it, whereas the inheritors, by default, they would get it, even without the shavua. And then we had a very similar machlokes about the fact that if he leaves already picked, detached produce from the ground after his death, then first come, first serve. If she gets it first, or if the inheritors get it first, then they can take it. And then again, if the woman took more than she actually deserved, then that leftover, again, has not been inherited yet. And we have the same achloikas between Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Tarfon would hold it goes to the woman or the Baal Chayv, and Rabbi Akiva said that Ein Merachem Adin, and therefore it goes to the inheritors. Since, again, they do not need to swear. The next few Mishnayos discuss about whether one can force his wife to make a shavua that she hasn't taken anything, or if she wants to collect her ksuba, making her swear that she hasn't taken it yet. So the Mishnah said, only if she works for you, only then can you make her shavua that she hasn't taken anything, even if you only have a tanas shema, which means you don't have any reason to suspect her of taking anything, but nevertheless you can make her make a shavua. But if she doesn't work for you, then you can't, because it would ruin your shalom bias. Now, once you're allowed to make her make that shavua using Gilgal shavua, you can make her make another shavua whilst you're on the subject, as it were, that while she was doing her other things in the house, she didn't take anything either. And according to Eliezer, you don't even need to use Gilgal Shavuah. You can even just straight away make her make a Shavuah that she hasn't taken anything while doing the other things in the house, even when not working for you. If one tells his wife that he's not going to make her make a Shavuah, then he can't, but he would be able to make her inheritors make a Shavuah. That they didn't know that she had taken part of her Ksuba. And if he specifies he's not even going to make a Shavuah, make her inheritors make a Shavuah, then he can't. But his own inheritors could make them. But if he specifies he nor his inheritors could, then he would be also to make any of them make a Shavuah. Then we said the inheritors can only make her make a Shavuah that she didn't take any of the money of her husband after the burial. But before the burial, she's too busy and she might have made a mistake, and therefore making her swear would make her make a full Shavuah. We then said five women who would need to make a Shavuah if they want to collect their Ksuba, even if their husband does not demand it. Number one, if she's been paid part of it, or if one witness says she's been paid part of it, or if she's claiming it from the inheritors, or from someone who the husband sold it to, or if her husband's not there, in all those cases, she would have to make a Shavuah. Then we brought Rabbi Shimon, who held that if she asks her Ksuba, then that would allow the Yoshim to make her swear not only for the Ksuba, but also that she didn't take anything during her husband's lifetime. But if she doesn't ask for it, then Rabbi Shimon argues on a previous mishnah, which we said, and he holds that even if if your wife works for you, you still can't make her make a Shavuah, and therefore all the more so, the inheritors would not be able to make her make the Shavuah. If a woman comes to Beis Din with a get but no Ksuba, she can still collect her Ksuba if the minhag of that place is not to write a Ksuba. Rather rely on what the Rabbonim said, that a woman can collect her Ksuba even without writing it. If she has a Ksuba but no get, then according to the Tanakama, she cannot collect her Ksuba because the husband who claims that he had a shovar, a receipt that he had given her the Ksuba, but he lost it. The husband has a migoy, meaning that he could have made a better lie, which was more advantageous for him. He could have said that I never divorced her in the first place, I would never obligated to give her a Ksuba. Since he didn't say that, he's believed, whereas according to Moshe Ben Gamliel, he added that once the Romans decreed that you couldn't keep mitzvahs, so they were scared to keep their get or their Ksuba, and therefore you could collect it even if you don't show your get. And this would all be the same for someone who is a Baal Choyf who is owed money and with a Prusbel. If he's lost his Prusbel, the same thing would be for that after the danger. They would be scared to keep their Prusbel. Lastly, we said if a child or a convert gets married and then they convert or grow up, their Ksuba remains the same. For a cotton, it would be 200 zuz, even though she's no longer a basula now. Since he married her as a basula, her Ksuba would still be 200 zuz. Whereas with a convert, since she converted after the age of 3, anyway, she's not a basula, and therefore her Ksuba would be 100 zuz, but it still remains once she converts. And again, this is because he has in mind when he stays married to her that they're going to remain with this Ksuba.